Hi, I'm Trish England, sitting here outside Atlanta, and welcome to Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Warland and the Racing History Project. Guess what? All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, also on the Internet Archive, archive.org, and on a number of podcast platforms. If you missed any of our previous shows, the unforgettable Hobbs, Bell, and Fitzpatrick expose, or the Rousing Escort and Fireheart shows, and the dignified GTU in Lamont, or the Wacko Insulin Management and Staff, they're on our website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and on iHeartRadio, Google, Amazon, Spotify podcast, now reaching millions of fans. Download the app and listen on your phone, car radio, or a computer. Today is our first transatlantic extravaganza featuring stars of the ancient times, Dorothy Schroeder and Terry Elwood. And we have present and future stars, Chris Dyson, and the father and son team, Bobby and Dylan Archer. Starting with the jolly good fellow of three prominent racing series, and plus all that, Dorothy Schroeder won his first championship in Trans Am in 1989, followed by 17 wins over the years to come. He's been a keyboardist for a major rock group, a broadcaster for Speed Vision, and has been the race director for SCCA for some 6 years or so. Terry Elwood is a perennial. What?
Dave? Yeah, Cindy is there. Cindy's on there.
Oh, marvelous. Okay, let's go.
Hey, everybody.
On.
How we doing?
I don't know. How are you? And we have Cindy Lux, the Trans Am 2 winner. Okay, this is wonderful. I'm glad to know that. Terry Elwood is a perennial favorite on Race Talk. He is an NHRA Hall of Famer and superstock, 2009 Motorsports Person of the Year, manager of Trans Am's driver orientation program, and chief instructor for the Skip Barber Racing School of Red Atlanta. Way too much info for one guy. Chris Dyson. I'm not sure I know that guy. But I think I put him in the first time's device. Hello out there, Rob. Chris has completed his second Trans Am championship after winning everything possible in IMSA. We're very proud of this young man. Thanks for joining us tonight, Chris. I know you're busy. Cindy Luck, yay, has tackled all the different classes in Trans Am and numerous other series as well, always with success and progress. Her career began in 1999, and she's currently leading the SGT Drivers Championship. So she's on a roll in a tough young crowd. All the best for the rest of the season. And we welcome the father and son team, Bobby and Dylan Archer. Dylan is in his third season, going into a new season with a new contract and a new team next year, while Bobby hangs on no next after a career of 23 years since I'm back. So we'll get some different viewpoints from these two drivers. Tonight is our first foray into the wilds of Trans Am at SCCA. I hope it will lead into a more diverse theater of the racing world. So, audiences, please mute your phones. If you have a question for us, please just send it via chat, and our producer will pass it along. Yay! Okay, I'm going to throw some questions out. Whoever wants to grab it is welcome to it. When did you decide to go sports car racing, and what series did you join first? Now, Terry, with his exception, he just wanted to experience turns in a landscape. So that's why he's here. So, who went sports car racing? Hello? Nobody went sports car racing.
Well, Dorsey started pretty young in it. What do you say? Had a little Fiat, Dorsey?
I started back in 1971 in a little Fiat 850H production car, and I ran that for a couple years before going into Formula B, which turned into Formula Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
But I've raced in SCCA competition, for like 17 years before I went full-time pro.
Chris, what did you start off in?
I started in the Speckracer Ford category. I did 3 years in that in the SCCA. I think Dorsey's urging. Now that I think back on it, we talked about it at length. I know Dad talked to him a lot about it, and it seemed like it was the best competition. A lot of local regional races in the Northeast, and really some terrific drivers to gauge yourself against. So that's where I started my sports car racing.
That was a good jumping off point. I like that.
It really was. Bobby, what did you and Tommy start off in?
Well, we actually, growing up in Duluth, Minnesota, we started ice racing with some Renault R8 Gordinis. And then the following year, I went and started with an F production Renault Alpine. And, we just continued racing Renaults and got us into the LeCar and GT4, and that was really the starting point of our career. We went from there to IMSA, back and forth to SCCA, IMSA, and, we finally made it to Trans Am in 1992 running the Dodge program.
Yeah, those are fun cars. Actually, I remember the trucks was exciting.
Yeah, that was starting out in 87, 88 with the Jeeps. Yeah, there was quite a few different types of cars in the mix. We ran some races for Celine, ran Corvettes for Kim Baker in the Escort Endurance Series, Eagle Talons. Pretty much every car that we ran for, they won't make anymore.
What does that say in the big picture? Oh, me.
Yeah. I think Dylan's got probably the coolest story.
Okay.
Well, I just, in 2020, whenever COVID came around, the Trans Am series started with Trans Am Esports stuff, and they reached out to my dad and asked if he wanted to compete in it. And he said that he doesn't really do much sim racing. And asked if, they would be willing to let me join, and actually ended up winning a few of those esports races and got to start a Trans Am race in 2020. And, there's a big gap of 12 years of not driving a race car in there. So it's pretty exciting that, now we have two full years of Trans Am lined up and just trying to make the most of it.
That's awesome. Cindy. I forgot about the sim thing. Cindy, I know you didn't start in the Viper.
No, actually, I think I cut my teeth actually from an old car that actually you and probably Dorsey drove from Paul Rossi's day. I started racing back in 1985 in a showroom stock A in a Dodge Shelby Charger, one of the old L-body deals. And I really think it came from the Firehawk series that Rossi kind of did for a while. And I'll never forget, of course, just being a newbie, living in L.A. and not really knowing what I'm doing and stuff, and bought this showroom stock car, and I just remember looking into the wheel well, the front, and it was a big crack, but it was being held together with a brake backing plate that was kind of riveted on there. I think that was an education, and I think the next race, I think my car got seized by the police on pre-grid at Willow Springs. Because there was no VIN number. Exactly. But I just remember, what do you mean there's VIN number? And so I called Paul Rossi, and he just started laughing and just, no.
I told Kerry Earwood, who's my co-driver at the time, we were 24 hours at Watkins Glen, and all of a sudden the car developed this peculiarity that every time I turned the steering wheel to the right, the throttle go wide open. And I said, why is that doing it? Anyway, so, Watkins Glen's mostly right-handers. And so I said, Terry, when I turn the wheel to the right, I said, the throttle sticks wide open. He goes, don't turn it to the right.
There
you go. Exactly.
Well, yeah, and actually, Cindy, that's a funny word. I know David did the book about shirt on stock, and that's a funny, like an oxymoron, because all of our Rossi cars were body and whites from out of Illinois or St. Louis. Yep. You know, they never yep. were any cars. He'd go to a junkyard to get the right dashboards and seats and stuff.
Yeah, I think actually the VIN number on the car was registered to a LeBaron. So yeah. He ran out. They're like, no, it doesn't look like a LeBaron.
They didn't sell yeah. a lot of those.
Exactly. So that was my first year in racing, so I definitely had an education.
Yeah. See, ironically, Rossi and I were drag racers. That's how I knew him. We ran the old Hemi Superstock cars, like I still have today. And I ran into him at Indy in about 85. And he said, aren't you doing the left turn, right turn stuff? And I go, sure. He goes, well, we're going to go to Road Atlanta maybe this year. You want to drive since you're working down there? And I go, sure. So he came down there. We had an all drag race team. The mechanics and the truck drivers and everybody were drag racers. And it's 12-hour race, and we won it. And I go, oh, hell, this is easy. Well, I found
yeah,
out.
Exactly.
But that first race seemed pretty easy. But that was big fun. And then the next was in St. Louis. And a 24-hour, and he goes, can you go to St. Louis? I go, no. Back then, I was doing the Chevy TV commercials once a year up in Michigan, and that paid me some money. I said, but there's a kid that teaches there. I don't really know him. His name is Dorsey Schrader. He teaches school there with Simon Kirkby, and maybe let me find his phone number, and maybe you can get Dorsey to drive with you. So they called Dorsey, and they think they won it. But back then, with no transponders, you know, who knows? But anyway, so Dorsey said, when's the next race? And Rossi said, well, we're going to Sebring, but that's Terry's car. He goes, well, you better build Terry's car because I'm coming. And that's how Dorsey got started, took my damn seat.
That's awesome. That's good.
So they had to build me a car.
Another LeBaron.
We won a bunch of races, too.
Yeah. Now some of the events were Imperials.
Oh, yeah, so you had the class. That's good. I like that.
Yeah, we were blessed. We won a lot of races, and yeah. Now Rossi was, you know, he was a drag. He was a good motor builder. So we went in a straight line like Stink. You just couldn't stop or turn.
Yeah, that was the first thing he taught me is how to get mega boost.
And you know Terry's the winningest. He's the winningest driver in Firestone Firehawk history, which went on for a long time, but. Him and Rossi, I mean, that team was so good. I'd still be with them today if I didn't, you know. That led me to a bigger career. And with Dodge, first of all, and Cal Choquette, and running GTU, and then the Jack Roush and all that. But anyway, Terry still to this day and always will be the most winning driver in Firestone Firehawk history.
That's fantastic. That's great.
Yeah, the residuals just keep coming.
Hey, Dorsey, I've got a question here from the audience. Dave Wallen here.
Question
for both Dorsey and Chris. How about a comparison between the Trans Am of a few years ago and the way it is today?
Well,
if you can answer that, Dorsey,
changed.
And also Chris.
Yeah, a lot changed from about 88 to 89. One of the best short track racers in the world, Dave Watson, was running the show as far as tech goes for Trans Am. And Dave had some ideas to try to help cut the cost down. And so that's when all the V6s started showing up. There were some fabulous cars. Irv Hare in particular, one of the V6s. Anyway, there was different formats. If you had a V6, you weighed a lot lighter than a V8. If you had a 4-speed, you were a little bit lighter than a 5. If you had a 5-on-5 front hub, you were a little lighter. So you could build these cars to spec, if you will. And they were real lightweight cars. Our cars back then were only, you know, barely 2,800 pounds. And they only had 3 10-cubic-inch engines. And the problem with that was a 310 was never made by anybody. So you had to cast your own block. You had to cast your own heads. The engines put out about 700 horsepower, and they were very lightweight, and they did very good, but they were a throwaway engine. They only lasted a couple races, and you had to do it all over again. So the factories were heavily involved. And nowadays, you know, on a cost containing issue, they've gone to the NASCAR 358, but it's about a 3-year-old generation engine. make a lot more horsepower, short story. But the cars are expensive. The difference was and is that back in the day when I was racing, we had corporate sponsorship, huge. We had Tide 1 year. We had this. Anyway, it was a lot of money, and so you made money. There's money coming back on the backside. And in today's Trans Am world, that's the missing element, is a corporate sponsor. Chris?
So I didn't get to drive. I haven't driven any of the older Trans Am cars, but I think that when you look at a Trans Am car from when Dorsey was racing back in like the late 80s, sort of early 90s, there is pretty much a straight line to the cars of today. And I think the cars of today stand out even more distinctively relative to the rest of racing, because Trans Am hasn't changed while everything else in the world has. You know, the cars are still brutally fast, you know, really loud, and viscerally really, you know, on edge. And I think that that kind of, you know, the core fundamentals haven't changed. I mean, the engine configurations have changed. We've got more downforce now than those cars had. You know, some different materials, but still fundamentally the rule book is not vastly different. And I think that's made for great continuity as far as what the driving of these cars is. And, you know, we've had some great guys come back who have run in that era. I mean, we've had Wally Dallenbach come back and Boris Said still racing, you know, and these guys who have driven everything, you know, all say, you know, the Trans Am cars are their favorite cars to go racing in. And I have to put my name on that list too, because they're just, it's hard to describe the fact that we're driving cars with, you know, almost, you know, in mid 800, 900 horsepower with no driver aids whatsoever. And that's something that, you know, the driver aids didn't exist back in, you know, the late 80s, early 90s. They were starting to come in. I know that there's always been rumblings about that, Dorsey. There was always some dark arts going on. But it's not been encouraged in the way that it has been in a lot of the other series. And certainly in a lot of the cars I've raced in my career, pushing that technology was always, like, top of the list. Your Trans Am is, like, deliberately old school. Very, very, you know, much a driver series. You've got to look after the tires, and, you know, the car's not going to do it for you. And I think certainly for me at this point in my career, but really for any driver, it's a thrill to drive these cars, and it really puts you to a great test as a competitor.
Totally agree with you.
It's not really on the topic of Trans Am, you know, in the past versus present, but kind of on the topic of Chris saying how cool the TA1 cars are, that Jack Hawkworth is a Lexus GT3 factory driver, and he's here at VIR testing a TA1 car, and I got to talk to him a little bit today, and he kind of spoke along the same words, that it's just, it's an incredible beast, and, you know, he's driven quite a bit of cars and just said that nothing compares to it, and just the nature of the beast and just how cool it was. So just kind of along the lines of what Chris was saying.
Absolutely. It's a safe package for the driver, and you can push it to the envelope and beyond, and it is absolutely the most thrilling car to drive that you could do, but you have to be a very good driver to get the most out of it.
Another question here from the audience. How about a comparison of TA2? I don't think anybody knows what TA2 really is. Cindy and then Dylan.
Yeah, I guess I can speak on that. This is Dylan, by the way. I've, you know, been competing in TA2 throughout this year, and we'll be doing it again next year. And I would just say TA2 right now is probably one of the most competitive series out there in North America and maybe even the world. You have 35 cars at the late, basically for every car count weekend we've had. And you look at what Trans Am was whenever I ran in 2020, there was only 14 cars that started the race. Now there's 14 cars that start the race that are capable of winning it. So it's just, the dynamics have changed tremendously over the last 2 years. And I think that goes to show what John Claggett and Tony Perella have done to make the series better. And Yeah, I would just say PA2 is definitely one of the most competitive series out there right now. You look at the talent, the guys winning these races are able to go score podiums at, you know, some of the biggest races in the world. So their accolades speak for themselves, and the competition speaks for itself, I think, as well.
You know, Dylan, I forgot to tell you the story last week with Watson Glenn, but Dave, to answer your question, I currently don't run in PA2, but I had to do a promotion here in Portland with IndyCar, and I had dinner with Scott Dixon, and the guy just kind of pulled me off to the side, and all he wanted to talk about was PA2 in Trans Am, and he's so enamored by it. Here is, you know, the IndyCar driver, you know, talking about PA2, but what he was saying was very interesting. It's kind of what Dylan alluded to. He says, down in Australia, he says, people are pulling out of the supercar series, the teams, and they're starting to go to the TA2 side of things from a cost standpoint and a competitive standpoint. And he was saying, no, I'm actually going to start a team the next probably year or a couple years down there and run, you know, a handful of TA2 cars. It's just so popular down there. So it definitely has the global effect.
The cost factor of TA2 is not even touchable by any, even showroom stock can't get to the level of the lower cost factor of a TA2 car. Then you go up against how competitive they are and how wonderful that series is run, administered. I mean, it's a dogfight. I'm not going to say it's not. You're fighting for your life out there, but like Dylan said, there's 14 cars that can win every race, and they put it on the line, and they put on a show for the fans unparalleled to anything out there right now. I agree with that.
Well, and that's the reason I went with them 7 years ago, that when TA2 was forming and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, what a great concept, you know, with you know, little small block engines, and they all weigh the same. And like Bobby and now Dylan coming along, you know, we've got some great young kids coming along, and we've got some great seasoned veterans. It's just a nice package. You know, they're averaging over 30, 35 cars. What did we have, Dylan? 48 was our record. Record this past year.
Yes, sir.
No, if you get a chance, you got to go see Dylan in the TA2 this next year. You're going to love it.
So we got Amy Rutan, and she's eating up everybody's lunch. And I think I'd like to get her on one of our shows one night. We're going to do one with just women racers before long. It's coming up.
Okay. Another audience question here, Trish. That actually
okay,
makes
please.
For everybody that actually for Chris Dyson. What was the most interesting race in the Trans Am series while you were winning? What was the best race you had?
This year, I'd probably have to say Sebring was comprehensively probably my best race, even though it was the first one of the year. Car was absolutely hooked up. I mean, we dominated it, so I'm going to pick that one. I think any driver would, but the car was just in a different dimension. It's probably one of the best race cars I've ever had around Sebring, and I've done a lot of races there. And those are special days, and it kind of underlined after, you know, 5 months away that we're still on top. And you know, sometimes you got to back it up the previous year's success because the first year starts with a zero balance. So it was great to put that one on the board. We got pole there, and it was just an absolute thrill. And that, I think, set the tone for the year. Road Atlanta was also – the car was really good there as well. You remember the days where the car's, like, right on the money, not the days you have to really work your rear end off. I'm sure Dorsey and Tommy all the boys on this call, boys and girls, Cindy, would probably agree with me.
Well, I watched you this past go round at Road Atlanta, and you were on rails. It was really fun to watch.
Yeah, I mean, these cars, you can get into such a good zone with these cars, and the new Pirellis are really rewarding, you know, us pushing. You know, we did a lot of development on that for the new 18-inch tire for this year, and it's been pretty spectacular everywhere we've been.
Well,
no drop off.
Yeah, you're being pretty humble there because you showed up at Sebring with a brand new package. What all? It's a bigger tire and wheel. What else was changed this year, Chris?
You know, honestly, Terry, that we didn't have to change too much. I don't think people had to change geometries or anything. You know, I think some folks, you know, have gone for the bigger front brake package. Obviously, with the Trans Am cars, cooling the front brakes is always the biggest challenge because you're just going faster with these cars than you are anywhere else.
Right.
You know, I mean, we're going 180 where most series are going up 160, 155. It's outlandish speeds. So, you got the better grip, you got the better ride control, but you know, you got to be careful on how hard you can run the brakes still.
Yeah, and I know, like Chris was talking about the speeds, I know at Daytona, the Speedway would not let us advertise that you guys were going over 200. We're not allowed to go quicker than a NASCAR car there, so you guys had to claim 199.
Yeah, oh, I got in a little trouble for that.
My goodness. I've never heard of such a thing.
Imagine that, yep. Not allowed to go over 200.
For the people that wonder, and since I'm out of the picture now, I can say it. You know, a Trans Am car on the same weekend on the same track was 5 seconds a lap faster than the NASCAR car. So if we went to Watkins Glen, we were 5 seconds a lap quicker, but they didn't want that published, you know, but I don't care.
What do you attribute that?
Well, it's a much lighter car. It's got a lot more tire. Mm-hmm. It's got much more grip, aero. It's got everything better. The only thing NASCARs do well is go down the straightaway. They do that very well.
Well, I'm sure.
Narrow tread, and you know, they're aerodynamic, and they got a lot of horsepower. Now Trans Am runs the same engine, so you're talking 800 to 900 horsepower, and but a Trans Am car sitting on an 18-inch diameter wheel, and I don't know the width right now, but it's got a lot of rubber underneath it. It's got a lot of downforce, and the NASCAR car is trimmed out. The sheet on the bodywork continually to make it lose downforce and get more straight-line speed because they run in more straightaways than they do corners. So it's not a surprise, really, that the Trans Am car is that much quicker, but they like to play that game.
Well, it makes sense now. Thank you. Appreciate that. This may not be fair, and you don't have to say, compare and contrast the rules, the cars, classes, and formats of IMSA versus Trans Am. Are you more comfortable in one series or the other, or are you equally at home in both?
They've grown apart. They used to be very parallel. IMSA's sophistication level is now at the very top, all the way to Formula One. It is absolutely at the very top of the game as far as making the car a perfect car, a perfect race car. They have full driver aids. They have incredible aerodynamics and wind tunnel capability, and they have the highest technology level on the sophistication of the engine there is in the world. And that's not parallel by anything other than going to European stuff, you know, WEC or
right.
Whatever. Those cars are so sophisticated and so much better than an SCCA car or a Trans Am car or whatever. And that makes them a different thing to drive totally. I mean, it's...
Right.
I was privileged enough to drive all of that, all the way up to the Audi R8 LMP1 in 2002,
yeah.
and the Dyson cars, and the Dyson cars, you know, that were phenomenal, just phenomenal. That comparison's unparalleled, and is it good? Is it bad? From a purist driver who, like Chris Dyson's talking about in running in Trans Am with no driver aids, with a straight cut gearbox with 5 gears, there is no comparison. The thing that bothered me about it was if something failed in the electronic end of that, I thought that I would probably be the I think the computer would live, but I wouldn't.
Oh, it's tragic. Oh, my. But, yes, I understand that. And pure, I don't know, there's how you look at purism. A basic car with no driver aids, that's pure.
Yep.
I
you
get
have
it.
To have
I get
skills.
It.
You would have had to have learned on your own or been taught skills to make that car reach its level. On the other side of the coin, with driver aids, you only need to know a little bit, and the younger you are, the less you need to worry about. So,
just that
you get that.
That many more things to break down, right? Wow. Anybody else have an insight into that question? Contrasting and comparing
the
inputs.
There's another question here from the audience.
Oh, let's have a new question.
Here's another question here. That's just actually probably talking to Dylan, first of all, about your favorite racetrack. Dylan, you've been to a bunch of new racetracks, so tell us about your favorite racetrack.
Right now, I'd probably have to say Road Atlanta. It's just, you know, it's a track that flows really, flows great, and you know, we ran well this year up until our sifter got stuck in third. But I would definitely say Road Atlanta. It's a great track. I think the atmosphere about it, you know, the fans turn out, and just it's an absolute great track, I think.
What's your favorite racetrack?
Hands down, Mosport. I always thought it was a man-eater track, and you know, if the big penalties if you made a mistake. So I've been fortunate. We won a lot of races at Mosport over the years. So
I agree with that. I like Mosport too.
Yeah, my ball likes it.
What about your favorite?
You know, you know, I love the Road Americas and the Road Atlantas, but there's something about personality in some of the older tracks. And I think from a driver standpoint, you know, even though Brainerd wasn't overly challenging, but it was the race fans there that made it absolutely just so spectacular. A little bit different from the Watkins Glen, but even the old days, even like, you know, the Nelson Ledges, you know, the tracks that really had personality, that you really had to be up on the wheel, you know, to not only go fast, but just to maintain the car. So, you know, I love the new tracks. They're great. They're smooth. They're fast, you know, but I think sometimes I kind of dig the older tracks for personalities.
Well, talking about personalities, Cindy, literally, if you look at the tracks you mentioned, they were designed with chainsaws and bush hogs. You know, where's the property line go? Well, let's go over there. And like Road Atlanta, my daddy was involved in when they first built Road Atlanta, and they'd show up on Saturdays with their weed eaters and chainsaws and design the track by the lay of the land. There was no engineer involved. No offense to any engineers out there. And today, you know, then you've got people looking for certain radiuses and all that stuff. But Road Americas and Mosports and the Glens of the world literally were, like I say, the lay of the land. That, even though Sebring is my personal favorite, even though it's flat as a board, because it's such a technical track, being 3.7 miles long. Dorsey and I got to race the last year. It was 5.2 miles long, where you ran the whole airport. But and my father and John Burns actually designed the current configuration we have today, turn one, turn three. So it's all. As a matter of fact, we're headed that way tomorrow for the Skip Barber F4 penultimate race of the year and SRA World Challenge weekend. So we'll be at Sebring this week. But I agree with all y'all with the hill track. Give me the Glen or Mosport.
Yep, I agreed.
Yeah, we accidentally.
Here's another question from the audience. How about the worst racetrack?
Oh, good.
Oh, I can give you one.
Wait,
okay. Come on. No, I mean, this is probably not a lot of the East Coast guys, but probably Holtville, California. You guys ever heard of that?
I would. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I would go down to not Roebling. not Roving Road in Savannah, but Hutchinson Island in Savannah was pretty dang bad.
Is it still there?
It is, but they're not racing there anymore. It stopped like 2 years ago.
Good.
Yeah.
Everybody I know has had a wreck there, you know, just didn't like it much.
Oh, man. It was tough. Look at racetracks, those road racetracks, when you date back to when I started and stuff, there's so many that aren't here anymore that were really, really good racetracks in their day. And, usually housing development is what took them over. Riverside being the most primary one of, Mid-America Raceways here in Missouri. There were some fantastic tracks that just aren't there anymore.
Well, how about some fairly recent ones that had all kinds of whoop-de-doo and then suddenly fell apart, like New Orleans, NOLA, and that big massive thing out in Utah. Did anybody race on either of those?
Both of them. And you're talking about Miller Motorsports out there.
Yes.
When Larry Miller was still alive. And he did the huge track that Ford was involved with out there in
that's like
Cuella.
Scary.
It goes forever, but it doesn't go anywhere.
It does. Well, in the dark with no lights? No, thank you.
Yeah, that was a big weekend. I was doing that for television when that happened. It wasn't planned that way, but it ended up that way.
Uh-huh.
Trish, we're going to be actually racing at NOLA with the Trans Am Series actually next spring. It's on the schedule.
Oh, I got the impression that they'd taken that off the calendar. Okay, good. I'm glad that it needs support, as long as it's not raining.
There's a new one out here by me in Lake of the Ozarks in Missouri. Lake of the Ozarks Motorsports International. It's a huge track. I mean, it's the length of Elkhart Lake, 4 mile track, and with elevation bigger than anywhere that has ever been done. I mean, it's so much more elevation that it's not getting great reviews. It's quite frightening. But that's what
I saw a video of a lap on it, and there's so many blind curves coming over hills and stuff that it's just like, whoa. Every move is wasting your time, you know.
It's the same from a spectator point. I mean, the elevation is so big that the cars come by you, and they go up over a crest of the hill, and they disappear. You don't see them for 2 more miles, and they're up on the other side of the world. If you're a pro driver, Terry Earwood would love this track because he doesn't make mistakes. it's good.
Let's all go over there and watch.
Yeah, other than giving you my seat at St. Louis 30 years ago.
There you go.
I'm over it. I'm better.
Are there any other tracks nobody likes?
Laguna Seca.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Every time I've been there, you've got some dipstick volunteer telling you where to park, or you can't park there.
Yeah.
It's not like that anymore.
Yes, it is. We were just there.
Well, it shouldn't be like that anymore. I do the Monterey Fest, and that's run by HSR, and, everybody goes, oh, my God, you guys are nice.
Well,
unusual.
For the Trans Am region, it was pretty bad.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. I've been there when it's been bad.
Yeah. Yeah. And, the place is falling apart. I was amazed.
Well, they're repaving this winter. They're shutting down for 5 months.
Yeah.
Okay.
They got the money to repave it, and they're the guy that's running that now, John, is really trying hard to make that come back together. Regardless of how good he can make his job, it's still going to be the most expensive, outrageously expensive place to go in the country. It's just like everything's expensive. Staying out there, just Yeah, it's California. That's all you can say about that. Or I will say about that. No, I might say more.
I need to do a station identification break, y'all. Please stand by. This is Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on racinghistoryproject.com and also on the internetarchives.org and on iHeartRadio, Google, Amazon, Spotify, and now reaching millions of fans. Ooh, download the app and listen to it on your phone, your car radio, or your computer. Okay, where do we want to go from here? Where are people more fun, Trans Am or IMSA?
Trans Am.
Okay, I think so too, probably from what I'm hearing.
Trans-Am.
Didn't used to be that way, but it is now.
Right.
So you've got stronger friendships built up in Trans Am.
It's a different environment.
Yeah.
It's not the people as much as it's how business is conducted. You know, IMSA is hugely political, and it's definitely manufacturer driven. And with that comes, you know, I'll say this: the higher you go in elevation of pro racing, the less fun it becomes. Yeah. Trans Am still is on the level that is friendly and you know, old school. And with that comes a lot of friendships, a lot of camaraderie, a lot of everybody helps everybody. Then you go into the real world of, you know, the manufacturers and the billions of dollars they spend, and then things are not friendly anymore. And pro racing in Trans Am was like that in my day. I mean, it was very, very hostile environment between a Ford guy and a Chevy guy and a Dodge guy, whatever. I mean, it's just the way it goes.
Yeah. Hmm. But we all remember teams where it was the whole family and they drug their car around on a flatbed and set up a camp, and, you know, that's how people did it. And there's a lot of racers that came up that way that hit the big time. And we can
absolutely. All of us on this phone call have, I guarantee you that.
Every one of us
is. Drug across the country in an old Ford van or something, some kind of Dodge van or something, and camped out in the back of it once we got the toolbox out. Right.
I can remember some families like that. The Leitzingers and, you know, those neat folks. I kind of miss
You'll
those
find me in the back. I'm still in the back.
I'll be on the lookout. Anybody got a question? Anybody? Question?
Well, Trish, the audience wants to know again, well, what about the future of the Trans Am? Where is this going next year and in the future?
That's a great idea. Take it away.
Might be a question for Dorsey and Chris.
Well, I don't know. Chris would be better because he's really involved in it. He's involved in its future as far as I'm concerned. And I would like to listen to that answer also.
And from Dylan. And from Cindy.
Well, I think it's certainly we've got pretty good date equity with the series. We're visiting venues consistently year upon year. Promoters are happy to have the series back. The crowds are good. Car counts are holding steady and growing, I would say, generally, both TA and TA2. It's kind of got a sweet spot as far as kind of not only the brand positioning and kind of its position in the racing culture, but, you know, I think they've also hit a pretty good value proposition for teams. It's sustainable. You can run a business there. You can go and do it, and compete there and in comparison to anything else in road racing, I think it's probably one of the best values for sure. You know, they're working hard to just kind of keep the rules stable. And I think that's a big thing, you know, especially with some of the economic headwinds that we might be looking at. You never want to be changing cars and obsoleting equipment. You want to try to keep the tent as wide as possible, so you give people an easy reason to go racing. And I think that, you know, certainly the cars are exciting. The TV, live streaming every race, I think, has been great for a way for people to see what we're doing and getting a lot of good in-car footage. You've got charismatic owners and a lot of great characters within the paddock who love Trans Am, who are the biggest advocates for it. I think, like Dorsey said, the environment in the paddock is really good. There's still a lot of camaraderie. There's good, hard competitiveness, but generally speaking, it's probably one of the warmest paddocks you can be in. And, you know, you put that all together, and I think you got a hell of a show. I think that, you know, both TA and TA2 put on great shows, nice 100-mile races within an hour. It's digestible for fans and for competitors, and I think for the folks watching at home. So I think if they can just stick to their guns and stick to their mission here, and like Dorsey said, I mean, you know, just keep going out and try to push hard to get the corporate sponsorship in. I think it's always a balance between corporate money and sponsorship and manufacturers. I think more often than not, the manufacturers have taken over a lot of things and in higher levels, the money gets better, but the rule book gets thicker and you need a lot more administration there. So, you know, it's a balancing act. I think that they're doing a good job with it. And, you know, I'm looking to expand, and I know that some of my other competitors are looking to do the same, and that's a good thing. And I know the TA2 guys, I think, feel the same way.
Well, Cindy, what's the story in SGT? What's that one like?
Well, it's kind of a little bit unique. It's the way it has been for the years, having a multi-class racing. You know, the TA and the TA guys and drivers, you know, that's kind of the more of the show. You know, with us kind of running the whole premise of being a production-based car, which really Trans Am started off many, many, many years ago with that philosophy as well. You know, so sometimes, you know, in our series or our class, it's, you know, we're wheeling, you know, basically street cars that have been converted into race cars, theoretically, you know, but still, you know, like at Watkins Glen, you know, when Chris was talking about Top End and Dylan was too, you know, for a street car, we're still wheeling, you know, about 160, 170 miles an hour going into the bus stop, you know, and for a 3,500-pound car, you learn very quickly to manage your brakes and your tires, you know, over that 70-minute program. So it's a little bit different animal on our side, but from a business standpoint, you know, for like Chris was mentioning, it's an easy way for me and our company to basically take folks that don't have the means to take their cars around but don't want to commit to a full season because their businesses just don't really allow their, you know, them to be gone that much. The model works for them because they're going to bright, shiny racetracks. They like the racing environment. So from a business standpoint, it's a good series for us to basically, you know, introduce new people into pro racing at a pretty economical level, you know. And that's one of the things I've always said, you know, about Trans Am. It's a pro series that, you know, it is very much of a family environment around the racetrack. If I had a problem or I needed something, even though we're not in the same class, I can very easily walk up to Dylan, you know, and or Chris or anybody else, and they would probably drop everything to help me find that certain thing. And that's one of the things that's very attractive. It really, really is. And it makes it very easy to convince others to go racing as well. So I think the future is bright. But one of the things that Chris has hit it on the head is when I first came into Trans Am, I came from another series, you know, in the IMSA series, where the rules were changing every single race, every other race. And I said, I can't have that. It's just killing our bank account. And I remember sitting down with John Claggett, and I just said, I need consistency and continuity and rules. And they've done that. They really, really have. So I think the future is bright. And, you know, they have a model that's very different, and it's a good alternative for a lot of racers.
Love that. Perfect. Anybody else with some insight on that?
Yeah, I would just, this is Dylan here, kind of regarding the future of TA2, I would go back to, you know, what I said earlier, that whenever I ran my first race in 2020, there was only 14 cars that started that race. Now, you know, our lowest car count this year has been around 38 cars, I think.
Wow.
And it just shows the nature that the series is growing, and I think the series is thriving as a whole. To have some of the highest car counts in the world in a pro series. You know, you look at the car counts that are competing with it, and it's all multi-class racing in Europe. So for a series in America, a single make series, to be competing with car counts of these other series, just shows the growth that Trans Am has had and the direction it's headed to.
Yeah, Dylan, I agree 1,000%. It's one of the best series out there. And like Chris said, everybody's listening, you can live stream those races, you know, so you can sit there in the comfort of your beanbag chair and see Dylan and these guys live head-to-head, you know, on a 10 race weekend next year. And then, of course, CBS Sports replays it in about 2 weeks. So they got great coverage, and it's worth watching. It's one of the best shows out there.
There's a lot to be said about not making your cars be obsolete on a yearly basis. These TA2 cars, you know, you can buy the next year's bodywork if Chevrolet decides to change the look of the Camaro or Ford decides to change the look of the Mustang. You can buy the three-piece body panels and attach them to the car that you had last year and stay up with the current, you know, configuration. There's been a few changes on chassis stuff over the years, but not that much. It's a very simplistic package. It's very effective in its own element within its own, you know, group of cars, and that's why you see so many of them. You know, when you look at these tube-frame cars, it's almost impossible to destroy one to the point that you can't fix it because you just cut the front end off or the back end off or the side, and you put a new one on, and then you throw the body back on, and off you go. So it's a very affordable package. It's the racing. There is no better racing than TA2, I don't believe, not with the amount of cars. And, you know, it's a really well-thought-out deal. I hope they don't change it.
Now, Ricky Brooks and the team do a nice job, you know, trying to keep the cars equal and keep the expense down. Claggett has an awesome team there, and has been for years. I was so glad to be a part of it for 7 years, but my drag car called me back. So here's the subject: Road Atlanta and Dorsey. I don't know the year, Dorsey, you can probably tell me, but we had a Trans Am race, and Dorsey's staying at my house. My daddy kept his houseboat there at my dock on Lake Lanier, and Dorsey and Fast Eddie's an oxymoron, but God rest his soul, Dorsey and Fast Eddie were staying down on the houseboat. So on Saturday night, I think Dorsey might have been on the front row, but on Saturday night we hopped in the boat and drove up to the Lantern Inn where Elvis not only cooked for us, but he sang for a couple hours. It was a Forsyth County version of Elvis, but Mike Jones. Anyway, so Dorsey and I split a case of Miller Lite on the way up, and one on the way back, and because it takes an hour to get there in the boat, and the boat knew its way home. So we get back about 2 a.m. and I have to climb up the hill trying to get to the house. Dorsey and Fast Eddie on the boat. So I wake up about 9 the next morning going, oh man, Dorsey's going to miss his race. I better run down there. So I stumbled down to the boat and, I said, where's Dorsey? He goes, he got up 7 o'clock to go do a warm up practice. I go, do what? Cause I guarantee you, I was still 4.0, if I'd had a reading at that time. So I go, well, get dressed. We got to go watch this guy drive that race car. So we got Cindy up, and we hauled to the racetrack. And back then we had some bleachers up at the bridge. And back then it was the old configuration where you had some runoff under the bridge, and then dirt and the tire wall. So
yep, I know that.
Yeah,
it's red dirt too.
Oh man, big red dirt. And when it was dry, it was red dust. So Dorsey takes off, gets up into the lead. He's leading, and I go, I can't believe you can drive it. I can't believe you got in the car. I mean, because I had to have Fast Eddie, and I was sitting between Cindy and Fast Eddie to hold me up, trying to watch these guys. So the full course caution comes out, and the field catches up to Dorsey, and I go, oh, man, he'll never make – and then he gets back in the lead again. Anyway, somebody blows a motor down in the dip in 11 coming to the bridge, and the corner workers are waiting to see if he left anything on the track. And the way you do that is you wait and see what the first car does. Well, here comes the first car, which is Dorsey at 165 miles an hour, and he gets in his oil, and – I never seen a car spin that many times in a short period in my entire life, but he spins out under the bridge, and then the whole field comes with him. So now we're sitting there in the dust and dirt, and you can't see anything. And we've literally, and we're talking about Paul Newman, Lynn St. James, Darren Brasfield.
I saw that. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Willie T. I mean, this was one of the biggest fields ever. You hear all these cars, you go bam, 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 you know, hitting each other under the bridge because nobody can see what's under the bridge. And all of a sudden you hear one engine fire up, button, 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 and here comes Dorsey's Mustang flying out of the dirt in first place again. And I go, they can't keep this guy down. They can't keep him down. I said, but I can't stay for the victory circle. I can't stand up. But Dorsey won what I consider, under adverse conditions, a spectacular race.
I got
to the racetrack, and my crew chief was a guy named Rick Pennington, and Rick was also the truck driver, drove the truck cross country. And I said, Rick, where's your sleeper cab? I said, open it up, put me in there, don't say nothing, and give me up like when I got 5 minutes to go. And so I went in there, laid down for a while, and he gave me 5 minutes to go, and I came back out. And here's the deal. There was nobody going to beat me because if I had died that day, it would have been a mercy killing. I come up underneath that bridge, I turned in, and there was this antifreeze and oil and all this stuff, and the car was spinning, and the back end of the car was sliding right along the tire wall. I went, if I hit this tire wall, I'm going to be flipping for the rest of my life. And I kept looking in the rearview mirror, and it was right on the tire wall. And then as you went down the hill, there was the tire wall went away from you. It opened up when you went down there at pit end. And once that tire wall got out of the way, I gave it about a 700 horsepower shot of full throttle and spun the rest of the way around. And when I did, I saw like everybody behind me spinning. I went, I got to get the hell out of here. So I went on and won the race. That's what I did.
I know. It was spectacular.
Smart, Alex. Oh, that was.
I think about 89.
The problem is nobody saw it. It was so dusty you couldn't see the crashes. I just knew everybody was in
there. No, but it wasn't good on my head, though. I knew that.
No. No. We had a pre-celebration the night before.
We celebrated the victory before it happened, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Somebody else tell me something funny. Ooh, dead air. Nobody's funny? You don't have any funny stories about Trans Am?
Well, you know, here's the deal. They're all still racing.
Exactly. Statute of limitations is that for Dorsey, so I can talk about it.
Yeah, they can't tell the truth yet.
Yeah, especially Dylan.
Especially Dylan, that's true.
Exactly.
It's saying something funny.
Everybody's
got something. It's not really Trans Am related, but it's funny that we're here at a VIR testing, and there is some two electric cars that are trying to break the Tesla track record, and they have two massive diesel generators right outside the garage to charge these electric cars.
<That's> Gotta come from somewhere.
Yeah, it beats carrying 3 miles extension cord behind you.
Yep.
I guess so. Major impedance.
Oh my! That's
yeah. To add to that story, they've got a whole fleet of engineers, and they're driving this 4-door electric car around with four guys in the car, and their goal is to beat the Tesla record. So they're trying to beat the Tesla record with four guys in the car.
Somehow that doesn't compute.
Yeah.
None of that does. Who else testing with you, Bobby?
Oh, there's Nitro,
There's Scott Legacy Racing, Scott Bocetta, Silver Hair Racing.
Oh, wow.
There's 18 garages and they're all full.
Damn. That's a nice. That's bigger than a race weekend when I started.
Yeah, no, it's very impressive the number of transporters and crew members here. Fortunately, we have some good weather. And, you know, this will be the first race where Dylan's been able to go test before he actually races. We're embracing the new relationship with the new team.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Now you guys race there in 2 weeks?
Yeah, 2 weeks.
2 weeks for VR. Yeah.
Hey, that Dylan, are you guys running up at Brainerd again this year?
No, sir. Sadly, Brainerd isn't on our schedule this year.
Yeah, I didn't know. I mean, that was the last time I've been up to – well – I only went up to Brainerd twice. I ran it in 89 and came in second, and then I was up there when you guys were up there. And that was, I think, your first race, was it?
Yes, sir. That was my first ever race. So.
Yeah, I thought it was, yeah. And I remember that weekend pretty well.
It was definitely a fun weekend with a lot of learning. So.
Yeah, I got that.
Yeah. But, no, you
have... All I remember about Brainerd was mosquitoes about the size of robins coming in hot, bam, bam. Big mosquitoes.
Yeah, that's
You got to really want to get there or be there because you can't get there from anywhere.
Well, I feel that way about VIR.
That's true, too. That's another one. You're right.
Not as bad as Brainerd.
I've gotten so lost.
You can get lost on the way there.
Yeah, Cindy, you got
to
put more miles on.
Paul Frewell told me once that he got lost trying to get to VIR, and he just threw his hands up, turned around, came home.
Yeah.
Paul got lost.
He was probably 5 miles away.
He get lost leaving North Atlanta.
About his driveway.
I remember going to Bristol the first time. It's the same thing. Going to Johnson City, Tennessee, you can't get there anywhere. You got to start somewhere different.
Yeah. Not many interstates.
So, Cindy, being the lady woman driver, lady, listen to me. You must have a couple of funny stories about guys and just stuff.
Stuff.
That's where we'll get in trouble on the stuff part.
Yeah, this could be a bad one. I don't really do well when I get asked this question. It's just a sport. You know, and everything's the same, male, female, whatever. But, you know, I don't think I've really had any bizarre stuff based on my sex or whatever. But the only time that someone took a swing at me after a race was a wife of a driver. So I thought that was kind of unique. But yeah, anyway, but that was, I learned very quickly to the old school, don't take your helmet off when you got someone in your face. So. But I really haven't, you know. I mean, I'm just kind of old school enough to where, but you got to understand too, where I grew up with 5 older brothers, and being the youngest, if you can't keep up on the motorcycles, you're staying home. You know, if you can't keep up doing this and that and the snowmobiles, no, you're staying home. So you just learn to keep your mouth shut and learn how to do it, and that's kind of what we do. So. Yeah, that's really about it.
But you remember when in Daytona, for instance, on pit road, there were no facilities for women. You could go to a porta potty if you could find one far enough. It's really hard to do when you're sitting on the wall and doing timing and scoring for a 24. But unless your motorhome is right there, you're up the creek.
Exactly. I've used my fair share of men's bathrooms. I didn't
care. What we had. We had the advantage on you there.
Somewhat.
We didn't need the porta potty either.
Yeah.
More info than we needed.
Well, it's kind of like the porta potties. Where was it? Nelson Ledges?
Oh, my God.
Remember the bathrooms at Nelson Ledges where you can see through the other side?
Oh, no.
Here's the deal, too. When Terry Earwood and I were running for the Dodge thing together in Firestone Firehawk, our nemesis was the Archer brother. Them two guys, too. But anyway, the Hacker brothers. The Hackers had these VWs, and Terry called them the Whacker brothers. And anyway, we had this secret weapon, Omni, Dodge Omni thing that had a turbo. And we only took it out every once in a while, and I got to drive that. And I had to run interference. And so Terry was running in the lead car, and I was running interference in the little Goes Like Hell. But I was really being a pain in the ass, and I knew that the Hacker brothers were going to come after somebody, and I wasn't going to be the guy that would come after. So since I was the sacrificial lamb, I stopped early. Terry was there on the victory podium, and they come running after me. I said, no, wasn't me. I said, the guy you're looking for is up there on the victory podium. Anyway, they had a feud going for a long time, them two. And you were talking about those trucks earlier. I ran against I ran against both of you guys, and when you had the Jeeps, I ran for Steve Saline for a while in those the trucks. And
did you ever pay me?
Risky. No, you know what? I think I came in second to you at that place in Kansas at Topeka.
Topeka.
Yeah, it's Topeka. And I couldn't believe if you hit a curb how those things would bicycle up on two wheels. It was actually quite fun. I only got to run it a couple times, but you guys were dominating it.
Yeah, that was our first $1 million deal, the trucks. Everybody laughed at us. That was a real
fun
deal for us. Yeah.
I already came out. I love. And wasn't Mitch Wright? Didn't he drive the third truck?
Yep,
third,
Mitch third Wright team? Too. Yeah.
And Mitch drove, and R.K. Smith drove.
Oh yeah.
Jeremy Shaw won a race with.
Was that?
Terry, did you ever get to drive one of those trucks?
No, never did. Never did. Never got a chance.
You'd loved it.
Yeah. Max said he could let you ride in the back of one, but I never got to that drive.
The truck series rolls over into Trans Am because in 1990, Dave Watson and Bob Anderson from SCCA came up and said, we're not going to let you guys win anymore. No matter what happens, we're going to disqualify you. So at that time, the series was sponsored by Shell Zone and Truck Guard Oil. And we were doing most of the promotion for Shell and the series. So when they told us that we weren't going to win, we quit. And we took the sponsor and went Trans Am racing. Then the truck series
that.
And we did it.
I didn't know that. Wow.
That's the rest of the story.
We had this funny race. And Bobby, you'll remember this deal because we talked about it earlier last year, I think. Anyway, we were running at Detroit in the downtown at Belle Isle. And I was as a backup driver to Ron Fellows in Tom Glory's car. And I was trying to get my job back. And but in doing that, we'd run out in California at Long Beach. And I passed Ron for the lead and then ended up spinning out and coming in third. And he came in first, I think, or first or second. Tom was
he never told me.
He never told me I was supposed to come in second, you know. And then when we went to Belle Isle, he said, look, you cannot pass Ron unless he breaks down. You cannot win this race unless Ron breaks down. If he breaks down, then you better win this race. You'll remember this deal because they had put this street sealer on the track, and a late race caution came out. Ron's engine broke or something. And then Tom says, you can win. But I didn't have a car that could win because I didn't put any effort into it because I was dejected. And so anyway, we go around on this pace car lap and everybody's scrubbing their front tires and there's no grip. I mean, no grip. And then we started getting grip and I started doing burnouts and I didn't have any rear traction at all. Like second gear, half throttle, it would just spin the hell out of the wheel. So I started doing these monster Don Garlitz burnouts. And Scott Sharp was right in front of me, and he said, Dorsey's lost his mind. He's finally lost his mind. You should see him. He's an idiot. He's burning the hell off his rear tires. Well, I did that whole lap. It took about a lap, and I started getting traction. I said, I got this race won because nobody's doing that. And that green flag came out, and Bobby, you were running second, I think. Anyway,
I was in the lead.
Oh, you were leading. Okay, yeah.
I was the lead roller. I was the lint roller for everybody else.
I went by that pack. I built a 4.5 second lead in one lap.
Yeah,
but then a caution came out and it made a difference. But God, that was dicey back where you guys were. I could see it.
No, I went into the first corner and drove right into the wall.
Everybody.
Yeah, everybody followed me. Yeah.
What a mess.
That was a lesson. That was a hard lesson to learn.
Yeah. Oh man, we had some good times though.
Yeah.
Okay, Trish, let's wrap it up.
Okay. All right. Let me get back here. Well, yes. I guess so. Okay, we're going to wrap it up. Anybody got last thing on the mind? Nope. Anybody got a mind blur?
It's always nice to be on a. It's always nice to see everybody that's on this call, and I hope that some of the folks listening kind of got an impression of the fun we all get to have together. And this is actually what the Trans Am Paddock's all about. If we were all together, we'd be probably telling the same kind of stories.
Opened my eyes to a lot of it. I'll have to admit, I need to pay more attention. I've been saying that for years. And this has been the best show for me because, yes, I needed to hear all of this. Thank
you. Well, you were there for a while, too. And, congratulations again, Chris, on your championship again this year.
Yes.
And I'm so proud of you. And I haven't met your daddy many, many years ago when he won the runoffs at Road Atlanta. So I've been a big Dyson fan all these years. And then, Dylan, I'm going to wish you the absolute best, man. Looking forward to seeing you in that Showtime car.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Bravo, guys. Thank you.
Dylan, all the best. Good luck, man.
Don't hang up. I've still got some stuff to go. And we're just winding down. And I'm just saying thanks to all our drivers for their stories and to our audience for tuning in. Thanks for listening. But now I've got some big news. Our next show will be Wednesday, October 19th at a new time. Probably a one-time-only time change here. At 4 p.m. Eastern and 1 p.m. Pacific, it's a one-on-one with Brian Redman, whose career includes F5000 champs, Camel GT champs, wins at Le Mans, Formula Starts, and the survival of a hurricane, and legendary relationships with random track cats. Don't miss it. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website and racinghistoryproject.com, blah, 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 and iHeartRadio, Google, Amazon, Spotify. Don't miss our next show. Until then, good night from Trish at Race Talk with Trish, and it's been a really good show. Thank you, everybody.